encouraged, not burdened by the history that they create. They know what is expected of them. They are Manchester United.
Listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Fergie Fledglings. I'm your host, Colin Dams, joined by Polly Questel today. No Nathan, but new ownership for Manchester United. News breaking this weekend that Jim Ratcliffe and Ineos are acquiring 25% of Manchester United shares pending board approval. The vote will be on Thursday, but that means the Qatar bid is out. And yeah. First thoughts, Polly, on this semi-big piece of news? I guess the only bit of news on the bidding process since about this time last year.
Yeah, I've never had strong thoughts on this whole thing other than, like, it would be very nice if the Glazers sold the club because they seem to not care about the things that I care about. I've thought everything was, like, very overblown because we were sort of choosing between, like, a bad thing or a different bad thing. I did not want Qatar to own the club. Manchester United did not need to be used as a sports washing project by some billionaire, Gulf Emirate, whatever. Qatar buying the club was no guarantee of success. They own PSG and they dominate a one team league and then don't do anything else. I've always maintained that the people that wanted Qatar wanted to win the transfer window, and that was about it. They just wanted money, sign players, sign biggest names, etc. And it's like, just put in a plan and put it in place. You know, we've been signing names for a long time. It hasn't worked. Having more money to sign more names would not change that. United have actually spent more money than PSG have in the last 7-8 years. And both teams have flopped on a bunch of signings. There's just no guarantee. And look, on the other side, there is absolutely zero guarantee that Sir Jim Ratcliffe will run the club well. What we know is that the Glazers aren't running it well. And Jim Ratcliffe is acquiring a 25% stake. It is reported that he will be the one to take control of the sporting side. We know that he's going to try and increase his stake over the next few years, and he probably will. So at a certain point, and the Glazers probably will never fully sell all their shares, which, what can you do about it? Nothing. Like, you can't. You and I can't do anything about it unless we can somehow buy their shares off them. But if they don't want to sell them, they own them. And I don't think it's worth being mad about, especially if they're not in control. And they have not run the club well. So by taking the sporting side out of their hands and putting it into somebody else's hands, it at least provides the opportunity that someone else may run it better.
Yeah, the reports this weekend suggesting that he wants Paul Mitchell, who was linked with Manchester United back in 2019. It was whenever all the director of football.
And like recently, because I think under Ragnick. I think it was like he was watching a game with Ragnick when Ragnick was here.
Yeah, they worked together when they were at RB Leipzig in the mid-2010s. But Paul Mitchell, kind of a hot name when it comes
to... But he also might just be a name. That might just be like a very quick, like...
It'd be like, he wants to bring in someone who's done things.
You know, when March hits and they would just be like, well, let's talk about Harry Kane to Man United. that might be what Paul Mitchell is.
Yeah.
Because there was another report. Yeah. There was another report that basically said this... I forgot, I don't remember the guy's name, but was basically like, he's the guy in charge of like Nice and he's the guy in charge of the Ineos cycling team. Like, he's the guy in charge. And it's like, he's going to get a job at United.
Right.
So where would that leave Paul Mitchell?
Makes sense. But yeah, Jim Ratcliffe taking over the sporting side. of things, again, pending board approval on Thursday. But, you know, half of the board are Glazers, and those are the people who have agreed to sell. And one of the reasons they agreed to sell is because, despite what the Qatar flag Twitter accounts will tell you, Sir Jim Ratcliffe seems to have pretty handily outbid the Qatar offer for share price. It doesn't seem like Sheikh Jassim and that, you know, consortium ever really negotiated their offer. It is like every single update that we got over the past year, every like non-update we got was just somewhere in the realm of £6 to £6.5 billion. It was always pretty clear that the Glazers wanted a significant amount of money if they were going to sell the entire club.
Yeah, well, $1.3 billion for 25% is about
it's 1.8 billion pounds. I think $1.3 billion, maybe.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
That's almost 8 billion. One thing that has never been clear, other than all the Twitter accounts, is does Sheikh Jassim actually exist? And the fact that there was a report that came out that was just like, one of the things that turned the Glazers off was that they could never meet face to face with this guy. It was like, if he doesn't exist, you can't meet face to face with him.
I mean, there's two pictures of him that we know of.
I think there's a third.
There's three, but only in one of the pictures that I've seen, it does show his hands. And we know that it's probably like, not an AI generated image because he has a normal amount of fingers.
But it's just like, if you were trying to, like, how could just some no name from Qatar be trying? Like, you would have to have some sort of, you know, if you were like some no name from Qatar that was like, I'm going to buy Manchester United, that's ego right there. you're not part of the Qatari royal.
Supposedly the crown prince of Qatar, right?
No, he's not. He's like somebody's son or something. Okay. But just by being like, I want to buy Manchester United, that is ego right there, which means I want the world to know that I want to buy. At some point, you're going to like come out and speak, and you're going to be photographed saying you're going to attend a match. You're going to do something. And the fact that we just have no proof that this guy like really fundamentally exists, that he's not just like the most that he might exist might be that guy in Iron Man 3, the Mandalorian. Well, not the Mandalorian.
The Mandarin.
The Mandarin. when he was just like, I'm just an actor. I'm just the guy. I'm just the guy that they tell that goes in front of the camera. That might be what this clean-shaven dude is.
That is actually a really funny comparison to make, because the scene where it reveals
he's watching the United Arsenal match.
he's watching he's like a Liverpool fan or something. he's just watching Premier League.
It was also fun. Like, have you noticed that every time there was like a tangible announcement about anything that had to do with like the Ineos or the rain bid, whatever it is, that was always preceded by Mike Keegan being like, Qatar expects to close this deal within 2 weeks. Yeah. It was always, as soon as that was like the warning of, oh, I'm seeing things about Qatar expects this, Sheikh Jassim's mad that it's taking so long, or Qatar expects this bid to be wrapped up in the next 2 weeks. That means, oh, we're about to get news on how they're moving closer to Sir Jim Ratcliffe.
That was the other thing, which I think you pointed out on Twitter, that was like every update from the people Qatar fed information to, or like fed all these puff stories to, was always like kind of insulting the Glazers, not just for their running of the club, but also for the way that they were carrying out negotiations. It was like, of course they weren't like happy about anything to do with you, because you weren't really meeting them halfway or meeting them at all, as well as putting all this stuff out in the press that's like talking negatively about them. Like,
right. I don't think they ever wanted to sell to Qatar.
Yeah. The Glazers don't
exist. Qatar existed.
They understand that people hate them. Like, that doesn't mean that they're going to be okay with you spouting about that.
If Qatar even existed, because on the one hand, where I'm like, does Sheik Gassim even exist? If the answer is no, who created him? Like, you know, if Qatar really wanted this football club, Qatar would have this football club. That it doesn't go in line with anything that Qatar has done to like lose a negotiation like this for something that they wanted. So I'm sort of like, is Sheik Gassim just the guy that the Glazers themselves created to drive up the price? They wanted a bidding war. They wanted an auction. They wanted people to be like, I'm going to give, you know, they had a high valuation. They wanted people to be pressured into getting there. You can't do that with one bidder. That was the thing, is when they announced, which, by the way, let's remember this. They never, ever, 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 ever said that they were going to sell. They what was the term that they used? Strategic alternatives, which could include a sale. You're muted or something. I can't hear you.
Oh, sorry, I was muted. Basically, it was like, we've realized the Super League is not going to give us the cash boost that we were
exactly
looking for. So we're going to find somebody else to help front the money.
Strategic alternatives. So they never said that they were going to sell. And all the economists were kind of like, oh, this club is going to sell for so much money. This is going to be something that we've never seen before. This is such an opportunity. Like, things like this just don't come on the market. And I was very skeptical at the time of them being like, really? I don't see that. But also, I'm not an economist. You guys are. You're smarter than me on this. So I'm going to take your word from it. And I'm just going to be like, I disagree, but look, I'm not going to sit here and argue with people that know a lot more about what they're talking about than I do. But that never seemed to materialize. Is we ultimate, like, maybe there was a third bid at one point early on.
There was that Finnish guy who was like, I'm going to put in $2 billion and the fans are going to give me the rest.
Right. Yeah. And then it really just came down to Ratcliffe and Sheik Gassim right from the jump. And like, Sheik Gassim's offer never really changed throughout the entire thing.
It may have gone up in the papers by like 0.5 billion, but it really never left the like 6 billion.
Right. Well, at first it was like Sheik Gassim's going to bid like 7 billion pounds. And it was like 4 billion is going to the squad and Old Trafford and redeveloping the area and everything.
And it was always for like,
oh, so like that. So the Glazers don't give a shit what you do with that, like how much money you invest after they're gone. They care about how much money you're paying them to leave. And if they're asking for 6 billion and you're offering 3, but saying, oh, but we're going to invest 4 billion into the rest of it.
So obvious that like from the start, their aim was to like win over online fans.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That was a central part of their like campaign or whatever. But the way that they
worded
their offer was like, we want to buy 100% of the club.
Right.
The Glazers don't even own 100%.
There was a report in like May that was like, Sheik Gassim's really annoyed by this. The transfer window opens in 2 weeks and he wants to get going signing players. And I'm like,
so he wants
to buy right. that is the most AI. That's like, go on to ChatGPT and be like, write a headline that Manchester United fans will love. The online Manchester United fans will love.
No, Sheik Gassim wasn't making this offer to the Glazers. He was making this offer to the fans.
Right. And that's why he has a lot of them on his side. Although, again, you're not on the side of, you might not be on the side of a he, because he may not exist. But to go back to,
Sheik Gassim is an idea.
Yeah. To go back to the economist, I don't understand. And this is the one thing I'm like, you know, eventually Ratcliffe's going to increase his stake until he gets 51% or something. And the Glazers are never going to fully go away. And I don't understand why. Because there was that initial report, which has been poo-pooed, that like, oh, they're going to put the club back on the market in September. They're going to put the club back on the market in 2 years when they think they can get more. They want $10 billion. And I was like, what? You can't. I don't even understand how this club is worth $6 billion, because this sport is the fakest ass sport. Nobody's worth that much. Like when the economists were like, they're worth so much money. You're going to see people coming out of the woodwork to go after this. And it's like, it's not really worth anything because you can't get your money out. That's the way the fan culture is United bring in ridiculously high revenues for a football club, for a corporation. They are nothing to write home about. Like Ineos has some tiny little department that brings in as much revenue as Manchester United. And that's the department that like Jim Ratcliffe doesn't even know exists. He's like, what, that? Like, who cares?
It's also pretty clear that like for him, this is kind of like a hobby that he's enjoyed. Like, I think,
yes,
I think Nice was something that he enjoyed getting in on. And he obviously tried to buy Chelsea 2 years ago. And, you know, growing up a Manchester United fan seems to have been a part of this for him. That isn't to say that he doesn't have ulterior motives, you know, in terms of his legacy or his image. You know, Ineos is a petrol company. They have been part of, you know, environmental issues. Sir Jim Ratcliffe is like a known Brexiter. You know, he's been vocal about, you know, issues in Britain that probably wouldn't make him very popular among, you know, the kind of people who live and vote in Manchester. So, you know, he probably has motives for becoming a sort of positive face, as well as, you know, Qatar obviously wanted Manchester United to be a political tool. But with Ratcliffe, it seems like this was something he, you know, has had interest as well as a track record with, as opposed to, you know, just on a whim deciding he wants to own the biggest football club in the world.
Yeah. But that's all that United can really offer. Cause like I'm saying, they have the revenue.
And he doesn't need them to make him more money. Qatar wouldn't want Manchester United to make money.
They wouldn't. Like, they don't make the UAE doesn't make money off City. Saudi Arabia is not making money off Newcastle. No one, you can't make money in football anymore because United's revenues are sky high. All right, let's say, first of all, the TV deals are starting to stagnate. They're not going up anymore. They're starting to plateau. But that TV money, every time they release a new TV deal, when you call up Napoli with a transfer offer, Napoli goes, well, we know that the Premier League, like, it doesn't even matter if you're Manchester United. If Crystal Palace call up Lazio and say, we want, I would use Milivojevic Savage, but like suggest him, he doesn't exist either. We want said player, and Lazio would say, oh, that player's 15 million. As soon as the Premier League gets a new TV deal, Lazio is like, well, that player's 32 million. And so all that money proportion, like as soon as new money comes in, it's going out in transfer fees proportion. Like all that money goes right back into the club and then into the wages. And when you qualify for the Champions League, when they miss out on the Champions League, the salaries get reduced proportionally. And then when they qualify for the Champions League, it's like not suddenly newfound money. It's like, oh, wait, but all of our salaries now get adjusted proportionally to this new revenue that we're coming in. And we're right back at square zero. And all this money, again, with the squad regulation costs and everything, you have to get down to 70% within 2 years. But like, which means United have been at like 90% of, like, if not higher, 90% of the revenue they bring in has gone right back to the club. The only way to get money out of the club is to take dividends, which the Glazers were doing for a long time. They haven't done it since 2020.
But they did it for 15 years.
Yes, but that's the only way to do it. And if you do that, everybody will hate you and throw a fit on it. And if you notice, there are FFP laws that say you can lose up to a certain amount. And if that money is put into the club by the owner. I think it's like $115 million a year. And the Glazers obviously have not done that at all. They put in zero of their own money every year. And fans are furious about this. So when you think about what the fans want, and like what the fans want is they want you to put in $115 million thereabouts. Maybe you could put in $105 million, but they're probably going to demand that last $10 million every year. If the Glazers suddenly said, we're going to put $115 million, or let's not use the Glazers because people will be like, there's years and years of pent-up frustration there. If a new owner came in and said, I'm going to put $115 million into this, injected into the team so we could accept those losses to make all these transfers, what do you think the fans are going to demand next year? Same thing. there's only so much you could put in. But the fans will demand it every single year. They you know, every year we have to sign the shiny new toy. So I don't understand. So when the economists were like, there's worth so much money, I didn't understand who really wants to buy this. Because if you look at a football club, the boom happened around when the Glazers got in the mid-2000s. You buy it, the TV money came in, the price went up, and the way to get your money back is to sell it for more than what you bought it for. And you mentioned this before. It's not a coincidence that the Super League idea fell off the table, and now Liverpool wants to sell and United want to sell. And suddenly all these American investors want to get out because you can't get your money out. You go to the NBA. NBA franchise values are just skyrocketing because there's a million different controls in there. You buy the team. There is a salary cap. So we can only spend this much money on player salaries. You don't have to pay to sign them. The TV money dwarfs that. Then you pay for your arena upkeeps and everything, but you also own the arena that you didn't have to pay for. You get taxpayers to pay for the arena, and then suddenly you own it. So when your team's not playing, you get to have a concert and whatnot. So there's just constant ways to bring in money. And again, the TV contract goes up by $100 million. The salary cap goes up by $15 million. And there's built-in money right there for you to just put in your pocket and go home. That doesn't exist in football. And the way the culture is that fans demand you put all your money into this team and you can't take any back out. Did you see a few weeks ago that statement by the Sheffield Wednesday owner? You missed this?
Yeah, I missed that.
Oh, he put out this statement that was basically, it called out the fans. And, everybody was like, oh, things are not looking good here. And I was like, it's about time some owner did that. He basically said, all the fans, all they do is yell at me and say that I'm doing a terrible job. And all they do is demand that I put more and more money into this club. He's like, and you're at that level, as most clubs are. The reason financial fair play laws exist is because so many clubs have local businessman wants to save club, buys club, pumps his own money into it. It doesn't work. He goes bankrupt, and now the team's bankrupt. And then next business, these laws are there to protect owners from themselves. Because fans just demand you put more money in and you put more money in and you put more money in and you don't take any out, which means eventually you're going to bankrupt yourself. And he wrote, like, I'm not putting any more money into this club. He's just like, I've been doing that. I've been trying. And all you're doing is abusing me about it. He said, if someone wants to take, he's like, I'm going to continue to run the club to the best that I can. Because I love the club. And if there's someone who thinks that they can do a better job than me, make an offer. And I am happy to sell you the club if you can make an offer. But that is football fandom and the culture of fandom certainly in the UK, to a T, of there is just this demand that you put money in and put money in and put money in, and you're not allowed to take any out, which is why I'm like, who would want to buy this club? So it's great that we got somebody to buy 25% and hopefully increase his stake. I don't know why the Glazers aren't selling 100%, because they obviously know that there is more money to be made on the commercial side, but I don't really understand, unless you're taking dividends, how you get that money out.
Yeah, but they also own an NFL team, so they're printing money already anyway.
Well, yeah, because that has the same
definitely
structure
not,
as the NBA.
Yeah. They're definitely not one of those NFL teams that pays cap penalties either. Like, maybe they did 2 years ago because of all the guys they signed to play with Tom Brady when they had that Super Bowl window. But
yeah, but the annual TV money is greater than the salary cap.
Yeah.
So before they even sell a ticket, they're in the black.
Yeah.
Like, your ticket sales basically just cover your operating.
You mean they're in the green?
Yeah.
Yeah. Black sounds ominous.
So the Super League was designed, the idea behind the Super League was basically we all make it into, like, obviously there's a ton of money is going to come in, but now that we're all guaranteed to be here, we don't have to have this spending arms race every year to sign the best, the biggest and best players. The best players are going to want to play here. We have, you know, but we won't have to be paying these exorbitant transfer sums every year to outbid people because, you know, like the NBA, there is no punishment for losing. You just, you continue to exist. And that would keep salaries, that would at least keep spending down, which would allow the owners to get more money into their pockets. Once that idea fell off the table, obviously everybody was like, well, I need to get out now because, again, like, the clubs have kind of hit the top of their value. The TV contracts are plateauing. So where else are you getting money from that you can get, like, as an investor? If you're investing, you want to get your money back. How are you going to do that other than selling the entire club?
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see if that TV bubble ever, like, bursts in a way. I think because of the length of the contracts, it's probably not going to be anything like catastrophic, but like you said, plateauing the way that it is.
I mean, the TV bubble will burst when, like, when we figure out what happens with the streaming and everything.
Yeah.
Because at some point that's going to burst. I don't know what the situation is in the UK, but just in the US, like, it's out of hand and something's going to happen soon.
I mean, that's a big part of the SAG-AFTRA strike that is currently still ongoing over residuals and things like that. But I don't
But at a certain point,
playing sports,
at a certain point, like, but that's like kind of the thing is that live sports is the only thing that drives people. Like, it's the only driver. Like, when Netflix got rid of password sharing, there are a lot of people that were like, well, now I can't get to Netflix. And they're like, all right, I'll just live without Netflix. And you know, if something really good comes on, you'll figure out a way to watch it. There's just so many different things, but the only thing that really drives people to, nobody's signing up for Paramount Plus because of Yellowstone.
I don't know. But, you don't live in Mississippi. There are people who are really passionate about.
Okay, all right. How many are really passionate about Yellowstone? Versus
not as many as are passionate about the Champions League, I would say.
Yeah, how many are passionate about Manchester United or Arsenal or anybody? Or, you know, it's not just the Champions League. When United are in the Europa League, I still need Paramount Plus to watch them there. Live sports is what dictates that, but yeah, the streaming thing's gonna, it has to collapse eventually. The UK is, you need to subscribe to Sky, you need to subscribe to BT, which is now TNT. You need Amazon just to watch, not even a lot of Premier League. We watch a lot more over here.
Yeah, it's I think with the like the 3 p.m. laws as well, I think a lot of things are still more complicated and probably always will be when it comes to British streaming. But like in America, we don't have a whole lot of, like, obviously you do because you live in New York City. But even that, like, not every United fan in New York is going to be able to make it to Smithfield for a Champions League game. Like in the UK, the communal aspect of, like, you know, pubs will have the Premier League game on, or pubs will have Manchester United games on. Like, I don't really have that around here. I would expect a lot of soccer fans are kind of in a similar situation.
It's not just, like, you know what's absurd? When we're watching Welcome to Wrexham, and you're watching this team in the National League, or which is the same number of teams as the Championship and League One and everything, they play every Saturday and then they play every Tuesday. And I'm like, where? And then they go to every game home and away. And I'm like, where do they work that they have time on a Tuesday to get there, to go from Wrexham down to London to go to
get to Havant and Waterlooville?
How does that work? Like, it'd be like me being like, oh, well, the Jets are in Baltimore on Monday Night Football. I got to get on a bus and take the bus 2.5 hours down to Baltimore Monday night and then get back on, like, every week.
I mean, not just that, they're getting tourists flying in from like LA to go see them play Dagenham and Redbridge.
Okay, but that's different. That is tourists flying in to Wrexham.
Well, yes,
to go see Wrexham. They are not flying in to the suburb of London to go see them play Maidenhead. If Maidenhead were coming to Wrexham, it's the people of Wrexham, the people of Maidenhead, the people of whatever small town is playing.
Dorking
in that
league. FC.
Yeah. The people of Nottingham going to follow Notts County on Tuesday night. Like, when they go to the other end of the country, how do they do that?
I don't know. I guess they just leave work late. I mean, in a town like Wrexham, you know, maybe most of the office is going out to the game. So,
right. I guess, like, if you run a shop, like, you're not getting any business anyway. But you have to be
guy who runs the movie store. Just be like, yeah, we're closed on Tuesday. I have to travel.
Right. I guess that's part of it. Like, I'm sitting on like a whole heap of PTO right now. So I'm basically just like, well, I got to use it or lose it. So I'm like, I'm going to Smithfield for all the Champions League games. But like, that's sort of because I have it built up this year. Like, I can't do that again next year.
Well, we're not going to be in the Champions League next year.
Right. Right. And by not going to be in the Champions League next year, we mean February of 2024.
Right. We're going to be playing,
I wouldn't even guarantee that we're going to be playing on Thursday nights just yet.
Yeah. I mean, we are currently in last place.
What do you think about Gary Neville's comments?
I have similar thoughts to what Grace tweeted, which was, I ain't reading all that.
Right. Gary Neville and the 1958
he's,
group.
He's still trying it because, like, it was very obvious that, like, David Beckham was potentially going to be involved as well in some sort of Qatar bid. Just the way that he was speaking publicly over the last couple of weeks, they were probably like, hey, put some pressure on the Glazers. But if there's anything we've learned over what's 18 years now, 20 years of Glazer ownership, is that they don't really give a shit about
who's Gary Neville to put pressure on them. Who's Gary Neville to do that? What does Gary Neville have, or like that? Gary Neville has his own football club.
Use someone else's hotel the right. night before.
They just lost. Gary Neville's football club just blew a lead in Scott McTominay fashion against Wrexham this past weekend. Who is he? Like, this is what I'm so like, again, like I said at the top of the show, I would like the Glazers to leave. And that's as strong as my feelings are, because everybody else gets so upset that it's only 25%. And it's like, relax. It's better than nothing, and they're like, we have to demand the Glazers leave. And it's like, well, you aren't in a position to do that.
It's like, what do you think we've been doing for 20 years?
But we are not in the position of doing that. The reality is football clubs used to belong to the community. That the club was a community thing. The community, they threw their money in the till, and there was a chairman there who figured out how to spend it and dish it out. That does not exist anymore. The club belongs to the person that buys it. And we created that in the 90s, when we floated this thing on the stock market to give us more money so that we could continue beating up on the Premier League for Sir Alex Ferguson. And we could run for Europe and we can go after a Champions League. And no one had a problem when we did it then, because we were winning and we were flexing our muscles. But what we did was we opened the door for anybody to be like, well, I'm just going to buy all the shares. And that's what happened. And those are the people that own it. So if they don't want to sell it, they don't have to. So when Gary Neville or the 1958 go, I demand, like, our demands are a complete takeover, and our demands are a better, like, revamping all of Carrington. It's like, demand for what? You have no say in the matter.
Yeah. Which it is kind of like, we're going to have a whole discussion on the Beckham documentary, but like, thinking back on 90s football in kind of the retrospect that we have of, you know, we didn't necessarily live it, but we've obviously consumed it in various ways and media, of like Manchester United and Arsenal were kind of the clubs that are just like, okay, who's the best player in the Premier League? this year, Ian Wright, Crystal Palace. Okay, we'll buy him. Andy Cole, Newcastle. Okay, we'll buy him. Dwight York, Aston Villa. Okay, we'll buy him. Roy Keane.
Right, like that was kind of the whole thing. Was like, and it was shocking that Alan Shearer didn't end up at Manchester United.
Yeah, and then they'd go to Europe and kind of get their ass kicked sometimes. Part of it was because
year after year,
English teams hadn't played in Europe because of the 5-year ban after Hazel. But also, like,
they were so tactically behind.
Italy was the Premier League back then. Like, they were the ones with owners who didn't give a shit about making money, and they were just spending it. You know, some of them had acquired their money through questionable means. You can read up on Italian history if you want to. But, like, Milan,
right, but also, the Milan also clubs, like, Juventus. The end of the 80s, start of the 90s, the Bundesliga was still very weak because of German rules and salary caps and everything. That the best players in Germany were going right over to Italy. And won the World Cup back then? Who was really freaking good? Germany.
Yeah.
And then who was in the World Cup final in 1994? Italy. The best players were there.
And Holland. I mean, it was like Johan Cruyff kind of started the trend, but they were all going to Serie A. It was like Van Basten, Rijkaard. And then I guess Barcelona as well with.
Also, Ruud Holland. England were so tactically behind. So everybody played a 4-4-2. That was it. Like, you got the ball out wide to your wingers, you hoofed across in, you had a big striker, you had a quick striker, and that was that. There was no such thing as parking the bus, because it was, we play 4-4-2, you play 4-4-2, we're both going to try to play, and the team
if you
with
parked
the
bus,
won.
That meant that you were the worst team.
Right, and the team with the better players won, but the team with the better players won not even that often, because, like, there was a year where United won Newcastle won the title on, like, not Newcastle, Blackburn won the title on, like, 65 points. Like, the league was, the best teams, like, United beat everybody, but also didn't really thoroughly smash everybody, and then I remember listening to a podcast where about in the late 90s, it was, you know, they took this team and they went to Juventus and Juventus beat them. I think, like, it was like 1-0 or something like that. But, like, United had just threw their attack at them and did very well. They just didn't score and they lost 1-0. And that's when, like, Ferguson kind of realized, like, it doesn't matter how good your attack is. Because you could have a game like that where you take 30 shots and you don't score. If you don't concede a goal, you can't lose. And that was Juventus. And it was like, if you get 7 or 8 good shots and you're able to score, if you don't concede, you can't lose. And that's, they came back in 1999 much more defensively organized.
They also bought the best defender, like the best up-and-coming defender in Europe. Yapstam.
Right, but it was also just... Oh, we learned tactics of, like, hey, be defensively solid, don't concede goals, and now we're ready to compete with Europe. So, like, you know, Fergie says we should have won the Champions League more than they did, given the talent. Like, throw the 90s out there, because we didn't know how to play in Europe until really 1999. And then the next 5 years were kind of like a team in transition. So the fact that, like, we didn't win, maybe in 2000 we should have won, but, like, it's not easy. That was such a weird season because of the other tournaments that they were in.
The 2003 team where the final was going to be at Old Trafford. And they also, I mean, they rinsed Juventus in the second group stage, and Juventus ended up winning it that year. They played Real Madrid in the quarterfinal.
Right. And Ronaldo went off, but, like, all of those teams were kind of teams, like, in transition. It was the 99 team was kind of on the way out, and the new team hadn't been...
That Galacticos realm, we'll talk about this when we talk about the Beckham doc, but, like, that Galacticos team, it's like full completion in the mid 2000s. They won La Liga like once.
That was the whole knock on the style was Zidane's Pavons of we're going to get the Zidanes, but, like, you can only have so many and you're going to offset them with academy players. But it was also like, what formation are you going to play? A 4-6? Because, like, all you got is an attacker. And this was the whole thing. They criticized Perez a lot when they let Makalele go, because they're like, Makalele is what makes this entire thing run. Like, because without him, we got to all do some defensive work, and none of us do that.
You have five wingers and one center forward.
Right. And then this was a criticism of United, was basically like that they tried to do like the diet Galactico version when Woodward took over. And they're like, they really like copied like the, they tried to do a knockoff version of like the least successful Real Madrid era. And they're like, what? Like, what kind of thinking was that? But even in the Galactico 2 era, when you brought in Ronaldo and Kaká and everything, it took them a long time to win the Champions League. They weren't exactly winning. Granted, Barcelona were like the best team ever.
Yeah.
But like even twice. even after Pep left, they weren't dominating La Liga. They won it a few times. Atletico Madrid beat them twice. They just kept winning in the Champions League because they know how to play cup football. They were, and it was the same. Zidane did the same thing that Ferguson did. It was, we have Ronaldo in his prime. All we got to do is make sure we don't concede goals. And like over two legs, if we don't concede goals over two legs, over concede any goals, if over two legs, we will get Ronaldo 6-7 opportunities, maybe in this defensive shell. That's enough for Cristiano Ronaldo to send us through. Like there was a year where they scored like 7 goals in the knockout round. That was it. And on one of their romps to the title, like they were a very cup football team, like sit counterattack moment from Ronaldo. No goals conceded. We win.
Or we'll take the cast off of Gareth Bale for a little bit and let him run around. And
right, score. That 1 year where they're like, that 1 year, he didn't play. He like wasn't playing in the Champions League at all. He was basically playing in the league because Ronaldo wasn't.
Yeah, Zidane then he had came on.
Ronaldo, like
he came on the final.
They needed him in the
injury,
final, and he won.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gareth Bale did more in finals than Ronaldo did. Ronaldo just hit that final penalty and took a shirt off.
Yeah, in a 4-1 win in extra time.
Right.
All right. So we didn't talk about the games coming up, but or we didn't talk about the win over Brentford. We didn't record after that, but they were awful for 90 minutes, and then Scott McTominay scored 2 goals, and that's about it. Do we think
I'll give Brentford credit though? Look, the numbers against Brentford pretty good. Other than the whole, like, a lot of shots for no XG whatsoever.
Right.
But, like, the numbers looked similar to, like, Crystal Palace and Nottingham Forest, where it's like, all right, look at the opposition. I'll give them credit, though. Like, Brentford tried to play football much more than Nottingham Forest and Crystal Palace did, and United kept them pinned back. And I think a lot of that had to do with Harry Maguire stepping up. Like, when they tried to pin balls out, he just stepped up and, like, not getting farther here. But...
Polly, are you suggesting that Harry Maguire can be a good defender sometimes?
Yeah, certainly sometimes. It's insane that he didn't keep his place in the team after the Crystal Palace League Cup match. For
wow.
The Crystal Palace match.
Outrageous. Glazers out, Polly out.
Brentford did try to play more football, but like, yeah, United's attack was just atrocious. And then you come on and I don't know why he didn't do it sooner, but like, yeah, 3 minutes from time, Eric Ten Hag goes, oh, you know, I'll put on the guy who's good at, you know, running into the box and getting on the end of a cross. And when he doesn't have to do anything else, because in this particular case, at that point of the game, you didn't have to do anything else. And McTominay scores 2 goals, the first of which was sensational.
Yeah.
When, the way he brought that ball
the
down.
Control and then the shot through the crowd.
That was sensational.
And the second one, too, was like the perfect last winner goal. Where it's just like bouncing around and it finds Maguire's head and he knows what to do with it. Yeah, it was.
And
it was insane how much fun I had those last 3 minutes compared to what, everything
so
that
that's
happened
what I was going
to
say. There's been a lot made because, of course, Kathy Ferguson passed away the day before. And this was, you know, sometimes it's nice to forget that like football is a process game and you do the process, you'll do the process correctly and you'll win. And if you're not doing the process correctly, but like, you know, sometimes narrative just fucking happens. And 93 minutes, this game was so awful. And it was just like, Jesus Christ, like we're getting played off the park again by another bad team. And then McTominay scored and my reaction was at first was like, all right, we're going to get we looked into
we got a point.
Like that was like a sensational goal. We looked into a draw here. And then right after the kickoff, something happened. Like maybe they turned the ball over and like United went right back down in the box. And I literally like right after the kickoff, I went, oh, we're going to win this game. I was like, it just immediately had that look of like, there's 4 minutes left. That's enough time. Like, we're going to win. And like, it almost robbed me of from the winner being like, not so surprised, being like, oh yeah, there it is. Rather than like sheer, where the hell did this come from? Because for those four minutes, I was actually like, it very much seemed like, we're going to go and do this. Like, this is what United does. And the symmetry and the narrative of it happening right after Cathy Ferguson passed away, like, you know, sometimes football just takes over like that.
Yeah. It's nice to have that. Because even like when we were winning last year, we didn't have, you know, comeback wins. And as, I don't know how to put this, as much as that is very much like a mystique and not a, it's not like a tangible thing you can measure and understand about the way football is played. It's kind of incredible how ingrained it is in Manchester United fans that like, that was just something that was going to happen for such a long time. You could just feel in the last 20 minutes or so, you know, after a dismal performance in the first half or something like that, it's like one thing turns and you're like, oh, we're on it. Like, this is,
yeah, they're like, people, when I say this, every, and it might be different for different people, but people will have a thought in their head of, oh, that game. There are games where they're not playing well, or even they are playing well or whatever, but they're down a goal, and then like the 85th, 86th minute, they score and get that equalizer. And you know, there's games where you score and get that equalizer and you're like, oh yes, we're getting a point out of this. Good. And then there's games where that equalizer comes and you celebrate and you sit down and you take 5 seconds and you go, we're going to win this game. And you just know that winner is coming. And I think a lot of people will now have different games will pop into different people's heads because they know the feeling that I'm talking about.
Yeah. It's pretty great. We should do more of that instead of losing one.
But like, do you think that we should do more of that if it means like playing abysmal for 88 minutes?
No.
I'm fine with doing more of it if it's like the first 88 minutes are still fun.
Right. I mean, if Scott McTominay has like a career second act where he is, you know, a weird quasi center forward super sub, that'd be pretty
cool. This is exactly the role that he could play. You're going to make runs into the box. You're going to get shots. We don't need you. The thing is, if you play him there, like, where are you playing him for the first 70 minutes of a match? You can't put him at the number 10. He's not a good enough passer. You can't put him out wide on the right. He's not a good enough passer. You can't put him in the midfield because we've all seen how that doesn't work. That game state was so perfect for him. And it's why it's like, all right, there is use for this guy to do this. And you could say there's use to bring him on for 10 minutes when you have the lead in that like kind of number 10 position where he can provide you with the energy and do the defending and help you on set pieces of, you know, having more size to clear out, to hold, to preserve a lead. He needs to have Donny van de Beek's roster spot where there's five midfielders in front of him. And it's like, oh yeah, you're on the bench. And if we are in this game state, you'll play. Otherwise, you're not, but also we're not 1-2 injuries away from like, you need to start.
Yeah. Well, trip to Sheffield United this coming Saturday, followed by Copenhagen and the Champions League. I would say it's pretty safe to say both of those are must wins. Now
everything's a must. Look,
yeah,
it's easy to sit here right now and say, because United are 10th in the league. So they're,
yeah,
same.
Chelsea territory.
We're barely above Chelsea.
Yeah,
barely above Chelsea,
especially for someone like me who's talked a lot of shit to their Chelsea friends.
Right. When I realized that on like Friday, and I'm like, oh wow, we might go into the international break below Chelsea, and then Burnley took that 1-0 lead, and I'm like, well, at least Chelsea are committed to not going above us, and then Chelsea came roaring back. There's pretty much an equal amount of teams above us that there are below us. And every team that we have faced that's above us has beaten us. And every team that we have faced that below us, we have beaten. Not soundly, not very well, but done it.
And there's not many of them.
But we're coming up on Sheffield United and Luton Towns in the next stretch. So we got some teams below us. So we gotta win those games.
Yeah, we need to win, and we need to start like pumping in some goals.
Then we got the attack.
Yeah.
And then we got a nice week where we play Newcastle and Manchester City.
Yeah. And not long after that, a week where we play Liverpool and Bayern Munich.
But that's the next international break. Don't get into this just yet. It's
right.
Is this international break, we have the chance to get some points because we play a bunch of teams below us in the table.
So that's going to do it for us today. I do apologize because I said 2 weeks ago that there was going to be probably an episode last Monday that didn't happen, and that there was also going to be a Man United Women episode, which did not happen. And both of those are my fault. I've been busy and not really allotted my free time well.
Look at that. The manager is taking the blame for himself. Nathan and I are not running laps because Colin failed at something.
I will run the laps for my players. So hopefully we'll be better about that and getting, you know, back on top of things now that the international break is over. That's it. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.